Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Local mayors in New Jersey continue to criticize how the federal government's responded to reported drone sightings. Federal authorities say they've not assessed any threat from these objects and that some are just fixed-wing aircraft mistaken for drones. The mayor of Washington Township, New Jersey, Matthew Morello, tells ABC.
There's really only two ways you can look at this. One is somebody knows something and they're just not willing to communicate it down. Now, whether it's a national security issue or they just don't want to tell us, we don't know. Or no one has any idea. And I find that really hard to believe.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi remains hospitalized in Luxembourg. The 84-year-old suffered a hip injury after she fell on a congressional trip to Europe. She'll need surgery. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with other diplomats from Turkey and the Arab League to discuss ways to assist Syria after the collapse of Bashar Assad's government. President-elect Trump will attend the Army-Navy football game today. This is ABC News. More than a dozen people were hurt, 16 of them transported to hospitals after two airboats collided in southwest Florida. The crash occurred at an Everglades tour business Friday afternoon. It's not clear what happened. Authorities in New York continue their work investigating last week's shooting death of the CEO of United Healthcare. Suspected killer remains in custody in Pennsylvania, says ABC's Aaron Katursky.
After fighting his return to New York to face second-degree murder charges, the Manhattan District Attorney says Mangione may now waive extradition and could be back in the city as early as next week.
Until that time, we're going to continue to press forward on parallel paths, and we'll be ready whether he is going to waive extradition or whether he's going to contest extradition.
Police say Mangione nor his mother were covered by United Healthcare. Now police say they're investigating whether he allegedly targeted United Healthcare because it's a large corporation.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Big news in Wisconsin this month, as much of the controversial anti-union Act 10 law was struck down in a ruling by Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost. Two takeaways on this. One, the ruling gets at the heart of what has always made this law so brazenly political, by defining public safety employees differently from general public employees. That decision was pretty clearly made not based on across-the-board policy, but on which unions backed Scott Walker for governor in 2010. It would be fitting if that is what ultimately spells the end for this controversial law. Secondly, this case is headed to an appeal, which almost certainly will end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. While this case still might be decided by the court's current 4-3 liberal majority, it's a good reminder of just how important the upcoming race for state Supreme Court will be.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The lawsuit over Act 10 will almost certainly end up in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, intensifying the race for a seat on the bench in the spring. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The judge ruled Act 10 is unconstitutional because it treats different groups of public employees unequally. The controversial 13-year-old law strictly limits public sector bargaining rights in Wisconsin. Michael Childers is a labor education professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says the law also brought the state back more than 50 years, as Wisconsin was a pioneer in the fight for workers' legal rights.
It was the first state in the nation that allowed formally for public sector bargaining and then became the first to basically greatly curtail bargaining rights for all but police and fire in the state.
Act 10 would be struck down pending a final decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which currently has a liberal majority. The Republican-controlled legislature that appealed the recent decision is hoping to drag out the case. But the public workers who challenged the law hope the court rules before a new justice is seated next year. Wisconsin's public sector laws of 1959 and 1962 are regarded as turning points in the legal rights of workers. Childer says Wisconsin's union participation was always higher than the national average until the passage of Act 10 in 2011.
They had rights similar to what most workers in the private sector in the United States enjoyed, which is the ability to bargain over hours, wages, and all other conditions of work.
Childers says Wisconsin experienced the largest decline of union membership in the U.S. over the past decade. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-30s, a bit breezy out of the southeast. Tonight, rain mixed with snow and temps around 34. For Sunday, cloudy and 42. Clouds and 42 again for Monday with a slight chance of rain, 33 on Tuesday.
Currently 26 degrees.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, we'll talk about that big Packer game against the Seahawks, while Civic Media meteorologist Brittany Merlot joins us to give us a peek at the weather for the upcoming week.
And Kristen Ambos is in from Point Mortgage with tips and available programs to finance your home.
97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, our weekly weekend review of all things related to the administration of justice in America and beyond, rule of law issues, court issues. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this first hour and also the second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, joined in our studio by my producer, Max. Together, as always, we are going to be taking your phone calls, your inquiries, your questions about things on our ambitious but achievable syllabus this weekend. That phone number is 855-752-4842. Once again, that's 855-752-4842. You can also drop your question, your inquiry into the Civic Media app, and Max and I will address those during the course of our first and also our second hours here on Amicus, a law review. Delighted, in fact, honored to have you with me this weekend as we discuss these important things that animate our lives and our livelihoods in our communities, our state, our nation, and our world. We do have a syllabus, an agenda for our discussion this weekend that once again takes its headlines from the newspapers and the electronic media outlets from around the world, including right here in Wisconsin and throughout the United States of America. That syllabus includes necessarily part two. Didn't anticipate at the conclusion of our last program last weekend that we would have a part two on pardons, but indeed, pardons remain in the news this past week. 1,500 commutations of sentence issued by the present president, Joseph Biden, just this past week. Another 39 pardons issued. We're going to talk once again about what those mean, where they go, who are the recipients of those commutations and pardons. Yes, indeed. Once again, providing a little bit of law school stuff on our weekend broadcast, all about the difference between pardons and commutations under the Constitution of the United States of America. We'll give you some sense of why it is that the president has accomplished these things, what his purpose was, and necessarily what the promise from the president-elect is about the pardons, the commutations that he may issue upon entry into office on January 20th, perhaps even on the same day that he is sworn in. We'll chat about the differences in those commutations and pardons that are now a part of our history and will continue to be a part of our history, anticipating, likely, that the current president, Joe Biden, will continue to issue more pardons during the course of his remaining days in office, and certainly that incoming president-elect Donald Trump will do the same. that he will also invoke his virtually unfettered powers under the Constitution to issue orders of clemency and pardons to various people in the United States. We're going to spend a lot of time talking once again in our first hour on Amicus all about that. Necessarily then talking about two other state criminal cases, not unrelated to pardons, not unrelated to presidents and the executive powers that they do and do not have. We're going to talk about this major announcement by the Wisconsin Attorney General. His name is Josh Call, just this past week, to add additional counts to the so-called architects of the fake elector scheme. Those three individuals who were here in Wisconsin, identified previously, charged but not yet convicted, presumed innocent under our state system as under our federal system, presumed innocent until proven guilty, previously charged with felony fraud in connection with the architecture of that fake elector scheme, now facing 10 additional counts based upon the allegation that those architects, the three of them, actually defrauded the fake electors themselves, turned the fake electors into victims, not criminals, but victims, according to the complaint that has now been made public. Again, that matter appearing and proceeding in Wisconsin court here in Dane County, which is Madison and beyond. We'll talk about what that says, what it doesn't say, and what it means once again for the future of the Republic, not only here in the state of Wisconsin, but around the country where, yes, indeed, fake elector prosecutions, including prosecutions of the actual fake electors, have been underway and actually have been regenerated recently. We'll talk about one of those cases in this first hour of Amicus Law Review. The other major case, getting some news also coming out of a state court just this past week. This one not in Wisconsin, but in New York. This is once again the status of that Manhattan fraudulent statements, that fraudulent records case. The president-elect, having been found guilty, he is now a convicted felon for 34 counts of violations of state law in New York. That's the hush money case that was brought to trial in the spring of this year over a period of 7 weeks. A jury in the end finding Donald Trump unanimously guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of having violated New York law. Still not sentenced. Lo, these many months since that time. Still no decision from Juan Merchan, who is the presiding justice or judge in that case, about whether the decision by the Supreme Court affects in any way, it shouldn't, but affects in any way the trial and the conviction and the movement towards sentencing. We'll talk about something that the deputy attorney general there, the DA in particular, has filed just this past week, indicating what the options for the justice, for the judge, are going forward, including a very peculiar proposal that would contemplate that the defendant in this case, Donald Trump, that we would assume for legal, for fictitious purposes, is dead. And the consequences that would flow from that coming out of the district attorney's office. His name is Alvin Bragg. We'll tell you about that. Those are the two cases, the Wisconsin case in Madison, the New York case in Manhattan, both of them involving in some way presidents and elections and the processes of government in our nation. Speaking of that, also on our ambitious but achievable agenda this weekend, once again, turning to the Supreme Court, 49 cases now on the docket of the United States Supreme Court, just under 50, probably going to be adding, well, maybe about 10, maybe 15 more cases to its docket before it's done. We'll talk about one additional decision just this past week in the area of immigration and homeland security, a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court affirming the capacity, get this, of an agency to do what its job is, Homeland Security, having to do with an immigration decision made by the Secretary of Homeland Security. Certainly not consistent entirely with what the Supreme Court has done in recent times, which has been to attack agencies. Here, a unanimous Supreme Court says, no, indeed, the Secretary, this agency of Homeland Security, does have the authority to act as it did, an affirmation, if you will. Another major oral argument among the four of just this past week involving environmental issues And we'll read the tea leaves on that one, having to do with NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, and the implications of what an environmental study is all about and how broadly that can be interpreted and applied. We'll also talk about some cases in which the Supreme Court has decided not to conduct oral arguments, not to conduct review. Sometimes those decisions not to grant what's called certiorari, that is this writ granted to cases where they decide to take cases. Here we've got some cases where the Supreme Court said, nope, we're not going to take those on. We're going to let the lower courts stand. We'll talk about why those are important as well, including one case coming out of the state of Wisconsin right here. And then we're going to spend some time talking about what is also one of the more catastrophic things that has happened in America in recent times. We know well about the assassination on the streets of Manhattan of the CEO of United Health Incorporated and the horrific consequences of that, the manhunt producing, finding the individual who's almost certainly the perpetrator of that crime. He is also presumed innocent until proven guilty. We're going to take a look at the gun. At the gun that he purportedly used in accomplishing that heinous act, and why it is connected to one of the cases pending right now in front of the United States Supreme Court involving, yes, that's right, ghost guns. We're going to talk about ghost guns once again, which has been on the Supreme Court docket. You may recall we chatted about the oral argument in that case, a case called Vanderstock versus Garland, in which the Supreme Court seemed to indicate that indeed the federal agency, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, can indeed regulate these ghost guns, these kits, if you will, that you can get online and produce, generate, assemble your own gun. It appears that that's what the shooter in that Manhattan assassination case did. We'll talk about the relationship between that terrible, terrible event in American history just recently, and the connection to agency regulation and agency authority when it comes to America's horrific gun problem. All of that coming up here on Amicus Law Review this hour and next hour as well. Again, always taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. Max and I will ensure that we get to you and respond. Whether you are online or calling in on the telephone lines, delighted and honored to have you be a part of our discussion on our Law Review this weekend, as every weekend. I'm going to begin, however, by continuing a discussion that we initiated at the end of our last broadcast last weekend, and that is about this major affirmation. This major horrific, the horrific events, but a major wonderful event ultimately in South Korea having to do with the attempt, unsuccessful, the abortive, horrific imposition by the president, his name is Yoon Suk-yeol, of martial law in that nation. It lasted only hours. In the one day last week, on Tuesday of last week, we talked before about the amazing and illustrative illustration of what people in a nation can do when they see their government doing something that is contrary to the basic foundational standards and principles upon which the government has been established. What did the people of South Korea do when President Yoon there improvidently, unwisely, almost certainly illegally, unconstitutionally imposed martial law, didn't last long, as we all well know. The people responded and said, we are not going to tolerate that. We are not going to stand for a government in a republic, a democratic republic where we are represented by the people. We're not going to let a political spat, and yes, indeed, it was and remains a huge political disagreement inside the Republic of South Korea, but we're not going to let that political issue prompt the imposition of martial law in our nation. They went into the streets and they said no. And they ensured that representatives of the National Assembly could go into the National Assembly and reverse that. As we continue our discussion here on Amicus, the latest news on that coming out just hours ago, just this weekend. What are the people in South Korea once again doing and accomplishing to take back their government? Discussing that here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Thank you. From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW. Mino and the Mayor.
I'm going to admit something that I normally would not admit. A lot of times I don't wear underwear.
We got to go to a break.
I don't have a cart, and I'm carrying this stuff.
Yeah.
I got my finger in the loop, holding my pants up, because they would literally go down. And twice, people stop me. Hey, John Mino, as I'm trying to hold my pants up and hold my stuff in my arms.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 till 9 on 97.9 WGBW and 98.3 WISS.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Solario. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host this hour, next hour, beginning our weekend broadcast, talking once again about the lessons learned, both for us in America and other peoples around the nation, here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond, and also for our elected leaders presently encumbering those positions and to encumber them in the future. And that is that the power of the people is considerable. At least it has been in a number of significant instances in the international arena, and that includes South Korea. You may recall, well, we chatted a lot about this on our previous broadcast. December 3rd, President Yoon there declaring martial law, accusing the opposition politically of paralyzing his government, justifying, he said, the imposition of martial law, prompting soldiers being sent to the National Assembly to prevent any sort of government reaction to that. What did the people of South Korea do? They said, no, we're going to make certain that our representatives have access to the National Assembly. They clutched each other and they engaged in a human barricade to prevent the soldiers from stopping the halls of justice from being inhabited by their representatives. Representatives went in and legislatively overturned the decision of President Yoon. And later on, of course, Yoon himself, through his cabinet, decided wisely that that was a bad, bad idea, rescinded the decision. Obviously, it did not finish there, because even since that time of a week ago, the protests have continued. People continue to be in the streets. Thousands of South Koreans continuing to insist that not only was this the wrong action, they got it reversed effectively by the virtue of what they did, insisting that their republic means something there in Seoul and in other places. And they've also continued that during the course of the past week. Many protests around the nation, in Seoul and other places. And indeed, just this weekend, late breaking news that South Korea's National Assembly has voted, yes, to impeach President Yoon, suspending him from office after that stunning declaration of martial law early this month, causing, again, widespread responses by the people. Protesters in the street, even as we broadcast live this weekend and replayed again a second time this weekend, those protests continue not only to continue to send the message to the world about what South Korea is and what it is not, but also to support what will now be the work of a constitutional court under their constitution to determine whether or not Yoon should be permanently replaced. That is no small thing. Yoon has been suspended from his office effective this weekend. And under the constitution, the prime minister, his name is Han Duk-soo, will step in as an interim leader. And that's prompting the opposition leader. His name is Park Chan-dae. He says, this is a victory for the South Korean people and for democracy. And isn't that the real statement here? Isn't that the lesson being sent by these thousands of protesters gathering outside of the assembly? Again, it's frigid weather right now in South Korea, in Seoul, jumping up and down, hugging each other, shaking hands, embracing each other. Over the moon, said one of them. This cannot happen again. That was by An Jung-hyung, who's a high school student who's joining the protesters against what happened
in South Korea. We know this has happened before. It's the third time that South Korean lawmakers have voted to impeach a president. 2004, they did it. 2017, the National Assembly, again, voting to impeach President Yoon. 204 lawmakers in the 300-member House in favor, only 85 against it. A few of them, 8 votes, were declared invalid. All of that happening even as President Yoon promises to fight his removal from office. He is no longer in a position of authority there by virtue of how their constitution works. The lesson, once again, the power of people to say, this is not what we anticipate, this is not what we demand from our government, and it is inconsistent. A lesson for us currently. It's a lesson for us in the times ahead. If indeed some of the promises of the incoming administration to do things that are wildly unconstitutional, that are simply at odds with how our republic works, things that would suggest that we're going to try to limit the role of the Congress, limit the role maybe even of the courts, to establish a unitary executive that brings inside of it all of the agency decisions, including decisions by groups like the Federal Trade Commission, the FCC, others out there. This notion that we have talked about at great length, that President-elect Trump has indicated he wants to accomplish in his new term, to consolidate power, things that are inconsistent not only with the norms of our nation, but also fundamentally, that yes, indeed, will draw the lawsuits, and yes, indeed, will draw the challenges in courts, but should also draw, in a way that they have not up to this point, the concern and, yes, indeed, the civil nonviolent protest of American people. On July 1 of this year, 2024, the United States Supreme Court changed the Constitution and basically said that a president, for the first time in nearly 240 years, a president sitting in the White House has immunity from prosecution, can commit crimes, can engage with her or his Department of Justice in ways that are violative of the criminal law in our nation, and there is nothing that anyone can do to stop that. Presidents are completely, absolutely immune, John Roberts wrote, for those communications, those engagements with the Department of Justice, presumptively immune, presumed to be immune for engagements with others. And you got to show that somehow those actions, which are violative of the Constitution, somehow can overcome the presumptions of legitimacy. That's what our Supreme Court said less than 6 months ago. The American population certainly has noted it. And there have been pundits writing about it, talking about it. We've talked about a lot on this broadcast. Americans are not in the streets. Americans are not out there protesting in the ways that South Koreans have, in the ways that the Israelis did long before the Gaza War, when the prime minister there attempted likewise to change the Constitution to limit the ways that courts can respond to civil rights and human rights. That effort also turned back, ultimately by the Supreme Court in Israel. People took to the streets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and said, no, we're not going to do that. Will we do that in America? Have we done that in America? Now the answer is, from time to time we have. Yes, indeed. 1960s, a time when America said we need to ensure that all people of all immutable characteristics have access to the basic trappings of life and housing and education and healthcare. As we see the very structures of a republic being challenged in the times ahead and in recent times past, what is our response? What kind of thing will we be doing if indeed we see the same things in our nation, the United States of America? That will be part of our commission as we go into 2025 and beyond here on Amicus. A lot of you always inviting your comments, your questions, especially your inquiries about those kinds of things as we proceed with our discussion this weekend on our broadcast. And that includes first up, a second edition, a second segment, if you will, on pardons, all things pardoned here in our broadcast. And that is because the President of the United States of America, Joseph Biden, 2 weeks ago, pardoning his son, Hunter Biden, causing a lot of controversy for exercising his constitutional right to do so, pardoning his son not only for the gun violation, the tax violation of the federal system, but also establishing for him sort of a blanket immunity for things that he may have done for a 10-year period. That pardon granted by the president under his authority in the Constitution, following that up just this past week with commutations of sentences for about 1,500 people, about 40 more pardoned just this past week. We're going to continue our discussion of pardons as Amicus Alaraview continues here on Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Local mayors in New Jersey continue to criticize how the federal government's responded to reported drone sightings. Federal authorities say they've not assessed any threat from these objects and that some are just fixed-wing aircraft mistaken for drones. The mayor of Washington Township, New Jersey, Matthew Morello, tells ABC.
There's really only two ways you can look at this. One is somebody knows something and they're just not willing to communicate it down. Now, whether it's a national security issue or they just don't want to tell us, we don't know. Or no one has any idea. And I find that really hard to believe.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi remains hospitalized in Luxembourg. The 84-year-old suffered a hip injury after she fell on a congressional trip to Europe. She'll need surgery. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with other diplomats from Turkey and the Arab League to discuss ways to assist Syria after the collapse of Bashar Assad's government. President-elect Trump will attend the Army-Navy football game today. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Packers head to Seattle. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Another game in prime time for Green Bay. The 9-4 Packers take on the 8-5 Seahawks tomorrow night at Lumen Field. Packers wide receiver Bo Melton spent his rookie season after being drafted by Seattle and says it's definitely a loud, noisy place to play.
It's real loud, Lumen Field. It'd be shaking. It'd be rocking in there for sure. It's just, I'll say it's definitely a loud crowd. They love the Seahawks. Great atmosphere for sure to play in.
Packers defensive back Jair Alexander is out for the game, still dealing with a knee injury. He tried to make a comeback a few weeks ago against the Bears, but had to leave after just a few series. Head coach Matt LaFleur.
I just didn't want to have another situation like Chicago, where you're in there for a couple plays, and it puts a bind on every other area. Puts you some guys in some tough spots in regards to special teams. And then also you want to get the guys that are going to have to go play. You want to get them the reps. So I think that's an important part of it.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow and highs in the mid-30s, a bit breezy out of the southeast. Tonight, rain mixed with snow and temps around 34. For Sunday, cloudy and 42. Clouds and 42 again for Monday with a slight chance of rain, 33 on Tuesday.
Currently 26 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported recently on the impact of Shelby County versus Holder, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision invalidating Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Anticipating even more erosion of the VRA, some states have passed their own state VRAs. It's not only the dismantling of Section 5, the preclearance requirements for states with a history of discrimination. The conservative justices also made proving racial gerrymandering harder under Section 2, and they've made it easier for a state legislature to dilute minority voting power. And in the lower courts, more cases attempting to keep individual voters from bringing voting rights lawsuits under the VRA are pending. With dwindling protections from the federal government, California, Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota have enacted state VRAs. Michigan, Maryland, New Jersey, and Florida have efforts underway. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund recommends that state VRAs should have preclearance requirements for municipalities which have patterns of discrimination. Rules should include a prohibition against vote denial or dilution through gerrymandering, strong protections against intimidation or deception, language assistance, a statewide database to make evidence-based decisions on election administration, and a directive to the state judiciary to support pro-voter and pro-democracy decisions. We have the recommendations at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Alba Show.
We're going to meet each other out in beautiful Seattle. My youngest godson lives out there. He works for the Navy at the Bremerton Naval Shipyard.
This is like your trip to L.A. There's always a connection over here.
Well, sure, because there's no hotel cost. I crash on people's couches. Right?
You are as innovative as you are cheap. That's a beautiful thing. You are correct. Thrifty, my friend. Are you sure Todd's a former Republican? Yes. Yes, he is.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk about news deserts and what that means to our politics. We'll wrap it all up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. I hope you can join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amica Solario. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour, next hour as well. We are reviewing once again the issue of pardons looming large on the headlines and in the broadcasts of our nation just this past week as President Joseph Biden announcing late this past week that he is commuting the sentences, C-O-M-M-U-T-I-N-G, commuting the sentences of about 1,500 people, pardoning 39 more people convicted of nonviolent crimes. Sweeping act of clemency. It is regarded as one of the biggest grants of clemency in modern American history. Recall well from our previous discussions that President Jimmy Carter, on his first day in office, 1977, issued a pardon that affected more people, about 200,000 or so, for men who had evaded the Vietnam War draft and committed crimes by leaving the nation, many of them going to Canada. He basically said that they are pardoned for those offenses, and that, of course, is called a categorical pardon. Mr. Biden's commutations are for individual cases. We know who these individuals are, who those people are who are getting commutations. What is the difference between a pardon and a commutation? A pardon wipes out a conviction. A pardon is a kind of thing that says, while historically it is always there, you cannot wipe out history. We would like to think, we hope that continues to be the case, that we do not simply erase history, but it does remove it from the official records, the annals, the reports, if you will, of criminal proceedings in our federal courts. And remember, once again, a president can only grant pardons as to federal offenses. And that's why when we talk about things in New York, in Wisconsin, in places around the country like Georgia, presidents have no power to impose, to extend pardons to people who are convicted of state offenses, only federal. But we know that a pardon will wipe out a federal conviction officially, legally, and so it's no longer there. And all of the other burdens that go along with a federal conviction disappear, even though, again, historically, it's always a fact that we know about what happened there. A commutation, in the contrary, leaves the guilty verdict in place. It still remains the judgment of the court, but it reduces some or all of the punishment. Basically, that usually means that the president has commuted the sentence, meaning reduced the sentence to sometimes time served, sometimes a lesser period of time, basically sort of standing the place of the sentencing judge and reducing the amount of time that that person has to fulfill a sentence that could be in prison, that could be for some period of probation and supervision, does not remove the actual guilty verdict or the judgment of a jury, the judgment of the court, which again is what a pardon does. In doing so, just this past week, Joe Biden says this. He says, America was built on the promise of possibility and second chances. He said the clemency orders that he was issuing represent his commitment to help reunite families, strengthen communities, and reintegrate individuals back into society. What he's talking about there is that's the mercy. That's the mercy that we see in the Federalist Papers. That's the mercy that explains why it is we have this unfettered capacity in presidents to grant pardons, not without controversy. As we talked last week in our broadcast, many of these pardons have been the subjects of huge amounts of controversy. That includes some of the pardons not only issued by this president,
but by other presidents. That includes certainly the pardon issued by Joe Biden as to his son. A couple of others we'll get to that are also controversial among the 39 in this group of people convicted, previously convicted of nonviolent situations. And so what are these commutations all about? Well, we know that many of the pardon recipients include multiple people who are convicted of drug crimes as young adults. Young adult drug crimes, again, nonviolent drug crimes. No one is injured. No one is killed. They go on to serve in the military. They go on to support families of slain U.S. troops, help charities, train local firefighters, all kinds of things that people have done not only to ensure that the things that they have done are part of their past, but also to reflect on the future. The Office of the Pardon Attorney, as we've discussed at great length, is the office inside the Department of Justice that is established long ago by the Department of Justice to provide sort of a clearinghouse. When you make an application for a pardon, it goes there. It should go there routinely so that the experts inside the Department of Justice who look at these things routinely can make an examination of them, determine whether or not those kinds of good works that a pardon applicant has done, whether those qualify for a recommendation to the president about doing that. That's what's happened in most, if not all, of these recent pardons. Those who received commutations essentially had their sentence reduced to time served, once again, meaning that they were released from home confinement in the coming weeks. Many of those were cleared, were given those commutations because of the fact that they were sent home during the course of the coronavirus epidemic, sent out of the Bureau of Prisons facilities to promote their health and the health of other people in our communities, sent home to serve the remainder of their sentences in home confinement. And recently, there has been an awful lot of interest among Republicans and others set to take control of Congress, as we know next month, tried to push for legislation that would have forced those people to return to prisons after they were released on home confinement during the pandemic. Joe Biden's orders on the commutations basically say, no, you can remain where you are. I'm going to commute your sentences so that to time served so that you do not have to return to prison if indeed there is some push in the next legislature to do just that. The recipients, again, who committed additional crimes or were confined to sober living facilities, who were not included in this round of commutations, will be the subjects of continuing review by the president going ahead. We know that there are quite literally thousands of these applications for pardons and commutations received by the Office of the Pardon Attorney, sent on to the White House every single day, week, month, year, huge numbers of them. And right now what is happening, as happens at the end of virtually every administration, is the Biden administration going through all of them, determining who, in fact, should get a pardon, that is a basic wiping off of the conviction, who should get a commutation to reduce the sentence to time served. All kinds of considerations go into effect. One of the things, of course, that animates much, if not all of this, is this focus on nonviolent criminal conduct of the past. We recognize as well an important thing to keep in mind is that all of these people acknowledging that they committed the underlying crimes, we've talked about that before. Supreme Court has affirmed that fundamental notion. When you accept a clemency order, you accept a pardon from the president, you are acknowledging once again, regardless of how you ended up in prison, regardless of how that judgment was entered against you, whether it was upon a plea or upon a jury verdict, however that happened, you are acknowledging that you engaged in the underlying criminal offense conduct. And that leads to some controversial pardons that the president has just recently issued. The people in home confinement, as I said, committed a range of crimes, including some nonviolent drug offenses, some Medicare fraud along the way, illegally prescribing opioids. And these are not non-controversial situations. Individuals, people looking at these things, always have different views about whether or not the presidents should exercise their mercy in these ways. Interestingly, in that connection, a couple of very controversial pardons among this group. Joe Biden commuting the sentence of a fellow named Jeffrey Yohai, Yohai. He's a real estate developer and the former son-in-law of Paul Manafort, who himself was the recipient of a pardon previously by former president, future president Donald Trump. He was the chairman also of course, Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. Mr. Yochai was sentenced in 2019 to 9 years in prison for a series of fraud scams. And the current president, Joe Biden, now looking at that application plainly with a through a non-political and apolitical lens, commuting the sentence of that real estate developer and former son-in-law of Paul Manafort. Arguably even more controversial, another recipient of this commutation, a fellow named Michael Conahan, C-O-N-A-H-A-N. You probably recall this from the news. He's a former Pennsylvania judge who was sentenced to more than 17 years in prison in 2011 for doing what? For wrongfully imprisoning juveniles in two for-profit detention centers in exchange for financial kickbacks. So this is basically judicial corruption. The Justice Department at the time called the case the worst judicial scandal in Pennsylvania's history. Mr. Conahan, former Judge Conahan, now getting a commutation from Joe Biden. In the statement, Joe Biden said that many of these people, including those, would have received lower sentences if they had been charged under current laws. They'd also been serving their sentences at home for at least a year, according to the White House reporting on all of these things. Joe Biden going on to say these commutation recipients were placed on home confinement during the COVID pandemic. Again, not these two that I just mentioned, but others have successfully reintegrated into their families and communities and have shown that they deserve a second chance. Big news with respect to all of these things. And again, more news certainly coming out. We have talked before about this continuing review inside the White House about whether the president should consider and even grant, extend what are called preemptive or protective pardons to people who have not committed crimes. You have heard me talk about this before. My view, a very bad idea, sending the message somehow that people who might be on the list for these protective pardons would be themselves described as folks who've committed crimes. Scratching my head about what those crimes would have been. We'll see if the White House in the coming days, just a little bit more than a month now, decides to go that down that road, likely to issue other pardons, other clemency orders in the times ahead in other areas. The Office of the Pardon Attorney, once again, receiving about 12,000 requests every year for clemency, for pardons, and so more of that coming up, which leads us to the other part of our story, and that is this continuing focus. The president-elect, whose name is Donald Trump, promising once again, perhaps on day one, on January 20th, shortly after he takes the oath of office on the west side of our Capitol building, going down to the White House, and he's promised two things. Many other things, perhaps, on his first day in office. He's promised this mass deportation. We will see what that looks like, if that could indeed be accomplished in any way, shape, or form on his first day of office. You could, I suppose, begin to put policies in place to work in that direction. But secondarily, he's also said that on day one, I'm going to commute the sentences. I'm going to issue pardons, he has said, for somewhere between 12 and maybe 1,500 people who have been either the subject of, completed their sentence, completed convictions, completed jury trials, with respect to their assault upon their insurrection on January 6th. This is the attempt to interfere with the counting of electoral votes on January 6th of 2021. He has indicated that he will issue pardons for all of those people. Again, unfettered capacity of a president once he or she has the authority to do so. The January 6th pardons would not be doled out through the traditional application process, according to many people who are looking at this. Plainly, the incoming administration in its transition group looking to all of this. You would see them see clemency orders perhaps issued more in the way that Jimmy Carter did it, perhaps a broad pardon, a broad clemency, clemency orders and pardons being granted. All of that, according to sources somewhat familiar with the transition process, familiar with the Trump plans very generally. More than 140 police officers were assaulted by the mob on January 6th of 2021. Damage to the Capitol, we know that well. Windows smashed, violence to physical property there, entering the building, rioters stealing property, damages in the millions of dollars. Most significantly, five police officers died in the days after the riot, several committing suicide, four people in the crowd died on that day. Judges, of course, who imposed sentences upon some of these well over 1,000 people have already been convicted of their offense conduct under the federal criminal code. Grand juries returning indictments against them, many of them going to trial, most of them pleading guilty, some of them expressing contrition for what they have done, some of them being resolute in their view that they did nothing wrong, that they were, in the words of our incoming president, they were patriots. They were visitors to the Capitol, which, of course, is belied by what they in fact did. Indeed, the judges who have reviewed those cases, they're pending in the District of Columbia District Court to this day. The judges, including judges who presided over these very cases, including a judge named Royce Lamberth. We've talked about him from time to time. He said, no matter what ultimately becomes of the Capitol riot cases already concluded, the true story of what happened on January 6th will never change. As we continue with our discussion of what may happen with respect to a next set of well over 1,000 pardons or clemency orders, talk more about that right here on Amicus, a Law Review.
From Ashwaubenon to Alloway, this is 97.9 WGBW.
It's the center of the Kringle-making world. Racine County wears the crown, and bakers like those at O&H create more than 10,000 of the delicate oval-shaped pastry every single day.
Just a great pastry. One that's hard to make, though, hard to replicate.
Peter Olison is a third-generation owner. O&H is celebrating its 75th year, but do you know if Wisconsin considers the Kringle our official pastry? The answer coming up.
The 500-square-foot corner bakery to offering our products by mail.
Baker Mike Massanella says their Kringle is shipped near and far. The tradition began when the Danes came to Racine in the late 1800s, and it is that past and present which created our official state pastry, the Kringle, in 2013. And it's a you-can't-have-just-one-slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review, and this, our final segment of our first hour in our weekend broadcast. We are talking once again necessarily about pardons because they loom large in our national conscience, our national headlines. Not only the pardons that were issued by Joe Biden, our current president, this past week, but also these huge numbers of clemency orders that he also entered, again, according to his constitutional authority. And the promises of clemency and or pardons to be issued by incoming president. And his name, of course, is Donald Trump. The events, of course, would prompt the pendency of those, the issuance of those pardons by the president, having to do with the January 6th events. Again, speaking to these very issues, you've got Judge Royce Lamberth, who is talking about what happened on January 6th. Why? Because he has presided over many of these cases. He said no matter what ultimately becomes of these cases, the true story will not change. For what it's worth, Royce Lamberth was appointed by Ronald Reagan many years ago. He's a senior judge in the D.C. Federal District Court. He said this during a sentencing of just last week. And yes, indeed, these cases continue to march through our judicial system. Lamberth added, speaking about his own experience with marching with Martin Luther King Jr. decades ago, he said the rioters in this case, 2021, were not peaceful protesters, nor are they hostages or political prisoners, all things that the incoming president has described them as. Instead, Lamberth said in this sentencing hearing of just this past week, they, meaning the 1,200 up to 1,500 people, they chose to trespass on restricted grounds, destroy public property, assault law enforcement officers, and attempt to subvert the will of an electoral majority. Conduct such as this, he said, is light years outside the aegis of the First Amendment. In other words, not anywhere near the protections given under our First Amendment to assemble, to speak, to advocate. Every rioter is in the situation he or she is in because he or she broke the law and for no other reason. That's a fairly strong rebuke. Plainly, he is anticipating. He's anticipating that our incoming president is going to reverse, basically, the judgments in many ways. If pardons are granted by him and many of his other colleagues on the D.C. trial court, anticipating that many of those could be reversed, some commutations. People have served sentences. There are people in federal prisons right now based upon their convictions. What are the numbers overall? The Department of Justice tells us about 1,500 Capitol rioters have been charged in federal court for the actions that Judge Lamberth describes here. All but about 300 of them have been convicted or have admitted their guilt almost 4 years after the events of January 6th. About half of the guilty rioters, or 645, have been sentenced to jail time. And those, of course, are according to the records of the Bureau of Prisons, the Justice Department. These are all federal offenses. And that, once again, is the reason why, under the Constitution, yes, indeed, the incoming president, a current president, could extend a pardon to any of these people. Many of them have completed their services, the services of their sentences. And indeed, to this weekend, the Justice Department, through the FBI, is continuing to identify and apprehend scores of people. We're not done with this, who were captured on video and photos during the course of that riot. Donald Trump, during the course of a recent interview, said he may make exceptions to his promise of pardons if somebody was radical, crazy. That's what he has said about maybe the limitations of what he may do. Those people have suffered long and hard, he said, however, speaking about the majority of the 1,500. And there may be some exceptions to it, he said, I have to look. Well, indeed, through the Bureau of the Office of the Pardon Attorney, indeed, the Department of Justice, if indeed there is this focus, should look at these individuals if their applications are made there. The Office of the Pardon Attorney, for the most part, again, often disregarded by presidents in the process. But what do they look at? They look at, number one, an understanding and acceptance of personal responsibility. That's what a pardon contemplates. And second, like virtually all of the commutations and almost all of the pardons entered by Joe Biden just this past week, some exhibition of some change in lifestyle, something about their contributions to their community, changes in the way that they've treated family, friends, the larger society in which they live, contributions to betterment of their fellow women and men out there, something that commends them to a commutation or pardon process. That's what should happen here. And question whether that will happen or if there will be, again, one of these very blanket commutations or pardons going ahead. Another big question being raised, of course, is what about those seditionists? What about the people, including the Oath Keepers, those Proud Boys, Stuart Rhodes, Enrique Terrio? We talked a lot about those people, the ringleaders of the seditionists, who are not only charged but found guilty and sentenced to large terms of imprisonment. They're serving their terms right now in federal prison. What do you do about them? Is the incoming president going to grant pardons as to them? They were the ones, once again, they were truly the architects. They may not have been in all cases, on the ground there that day, but the way they were who organized the events of that day, charged with seditious conspiracy, that is planning for and putting together the trappings of what happened on that day. Some of them sentenced to about 2 decades in prison. And they, of course, are also hoping that the incoming president will basically pardon them, and arguing perhaps that they didn't personally engage in violence, but certainly responsible for organizing those who did. All of that also among the questions to be answered by an incoming administration as all of this goes forward. Proud Boys, the 3 percenters, all of those people engaged in similar conduct on January 6th, focused on trying to overturn our government, and now arguably on a list, presumably a long list, of people who may be the recipients of pardons. These things, as I say, continue to be subjects of great controversy for every president during the course of a term, especially now. It will continue to be controversial in the last days of Joe Biden's administration as he issues more of these. And it looks as if we're going to begin the administration of the incoming president, Donald Trump, equally on a footing of controversy as he at least considers, if he doesn't grant pardons or commutations of sentence for many of these people and arguably others who have done like things. We know that in the past he has also pardoned the likes of Roger Stone and Steve Bannon, Paul Manafort, other people. Charles Kushner, convicted likewise in a federal court, now going on to be likely our ambassador to France. All of that, a part of the national discussion appropriately, also here on Amicus Law Review. We'll continue with more about the rule of law and justice in America as we continue in our second hour, coming up after this.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Pete Schwabba. On the next Nightlight, I welcome talent manager and actress Heather Arndt and Appleton-based comedian Rob Brackenridge, who drops by the studio for some laughs. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Finding the special health care resources families need just got easier. Wisconsin Wayfinder, Children's Resource Network, helps kids with delays, disabilities, special health care needs, and mental health conditions. Call toll-free 877-947-2929. Ask questions. Get answers. Connect today toll-free 877-947-2929. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. There's new information about the 5 days that passed between the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City and the arrest of his suspected killer, Luigi Mangione, in Altoona, Pennsylvania. ABC's Ike Jachi has more.
The FBI is saying it received a tip about the identity of the suspect from police in San Francisco 4 days after the shooting. NYPD confirming that message wasn't appropriately prioritized.
Authorities in New York say they believe Mangione might drop his fight against extradition. He remains in custody in Pennsylvania. President-elect Donald Trump said on social media that Republicans will do everything in their power to end daylight saving time. He'll attend the Army-Navy football game today. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi remains in a hospital in Luxembourg. The 84-year-old suffered a hip injury after she fell on a congressional trip. She'll require surgery. This is ABC News.